This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, this is the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast from Literary Hub, where we believe that every issue in your Twitter feed or on the evening news has already been tackled somewhere in literature. I'm Vivi Ganeshanathan, also known as Sugi, author of the novel Love Marriage.
And I'm Whitney Terrell, author of the novel The Good Lieutenant.
So, Whit, I know you love Ralph Ellison and that our mutual teacher, Jim McPherson, was a huge influence for you, and that's part of how this show started. And now you write about, among other things, Kansas City and race. So how would your career have been different if you hadn't been reading Black history and Black authors?
Well, I mean, you know, I wouldn't have written any of the books that I think I've written. I mean, that I know I've written. I wasn't really reading Black writers. I wasn't taught Black writers when I was in high school and even that much in college. But the entire intellectual history that I learned from James McPherson when I was at Iowa was an incredibly transformational way, taught me to re-see the city that I had myself grown up in and understand things about the city that had been hidden from me. And that exact understanding became the source material for books like The Huntsman and The King of Kings County, and even the book that I'm working on now. How about yourself?
I think I was really, really, really lucky to have had several Black writers be my teachers. And that was true in college and in graduate school. I got to work with Jamaica Kincaid, Patricia Powell, Zizi Packer, Jim. And I can't imagine what I would be writing about without having studied with those teachers and without my having read Black and Black American writers who are, I think, you know, kind of my moral and aesthetic North Star.
Like Toni Morrison.
I mean, I think Toni Morrison is...
Who, by the way, I would have loved to study with. And her class was very highly in demand. I did go to the school where she taught and I couldn't get in. But... It's my one great regret.
The school where she taught. Yeah. The school where she taught. That's how we're now referring to Princeton on this podcast. So anyway, Toni Morrison is, I think, always, how could you not start this conversation with her? But I think these days, books about Black history, and I'm including here complex fictional depictions of Black life, are among those most likely to face criticism and to be the targets of book bans.
Last week, we discussed the implications of banning books with Garth Greenwell, particularly books containing sexually explicit content. Today, we'll be continuing that conversation with Farah Jasmine Griffin, with a focus on the importance of Black literature and recent attempts to censor it. Farah is the chair of African American and African Diaspora Studies, director of the Institute for Research in African American Studies, and the William B. Ransford Professor of English and Comparative Literature and African American Studies at Columbia University. She has published widely on issues of race and gender, feminism, jazz, and cultural politics. Her work has appeared in Essence, The New York Times, The Washington Post, and many other places. Griffin is the author of Who Set You Flowin', The African-American Migration Narrative, and Read Until You Understand the Profound Wisdom of Black Life and Literature, which came out last year. Farah, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you with us. Last November, you wrote an article for The Washington Post, which was called Banning Toni Morrison's Books Doesn't Protect Kids, It Just Sanitizes Racism. And Morrison's The Bluest Eye was removed from library shelves in a Missouri school just last month. Whitney's in Missouri and I'm in Minneapolis.
It wasn't my fault. I didn't do it.
When we think about learning the history of racism in our country, I think parents often assume that this is the role of the textbook. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the particular role of literature here. Because, you know, if language portraying the assault of a young African-American girl is considered too explicit, which is one argument that's offered against The Bluest Eye, then what does that say about the realities of harm committed against Black Americans, which is ongoing in this country? And what effect does that sanitized racism and violence have on our society?
Yes, well, it's often works of literature, literary works that become the subject of controversy and banned. Sometimes it's textbooks because of what they leave out or the way they portray things, but it really is, you know, it's Huck Finn, right, that we come to time and time again. And I think it's because literature makes things real. They make them. They make history come alive. They aren't works of history, but they are historical in some senses, right? And that they are a way for people to experience something that might be different from themselves. So it makes sense that literature becomes the topic of controversy. And, you know, I think that in all these discussions about banning books like The Bluest Eye, there's never a real discussion about who we're banning it for. Is there some teacher there teaching The Bluest Eye to a third grader? If that's the case, it's inappropriate and it ought not be taught. But if there's a teacher there teaching it to a 12th grader in an AP English class, I think those students can handle it. And the job of a good teacher and a good school is to offer a critical way of understanding, to provide a context and a safe place. It's why we read Homer. You'd have to ban Homer if you were banning The Bluest Eye for the reasons that you say you're banning it.
Well, I mean, that's the main problem, right? It's not being banned for the reasons that they're saying it, I think. I mean, your book begins with a discussion of The Bluest Eye. It's obviously an important book to you. I mean, what is it? Let's talk about what's really being banned here. It's like a discussion of the difficulty, and you emphasize in your essay, you know, that Morrison was trying to talk about how difficult this life was, right, for this young girl.
No.
And being honest about that is what people are having a problem with, I think.
Right. The honesty of the difficulty that not only that her characters are going through, but that many people, including the young people who will be reading this, might go through or might have experienced, and that literature is a way of containing and controlling it, those narratives, so that we can talk about them, so that we can break them open and discuss them. And The Bluest Eye is certainly about a young girl who experiences incest, but it is not only about that. It's about the failure of her community to care for her, which I think is really the lesson that we could learn from that book. And there are examples of how best to care for her, how other children care for her, how other children do her harm. And certainly those are lessons that young people could learn. But really, it's about banning books that tell of the difficulties of a particular group of people, particularly in this instance, African-American people, and not wanting to have young people confront the truth of that history.
Well, we're having you on because we think that it's very important to talk about. And you're in your book that we're going to ask you to read from, Read Until You Understand, is really about why that history is important to every American. And Black literature is a great treasure, you know, one of our greatest resources as a nation. So anyway, I wondered if you could read to us from the introduction to that book.
Certainly, happy to. Both the autobiographical reflections and my readings of the literature speak to the ideals and failures of the U.S. experiment with democracy. My goal in writing this book is to draw upon a lifetime of reading and almost 30 years of teaching African-American literature to explore how, in addition to addressing concerns about democracy, perhaps even more than these, the works also speak to ideas and values that have concerned humanity since the beginning of time. Within these pages, I seek to share a series of valuable lessons learned from those who have sought to better a nation that depends upon, and yet too often despises them. In the process, they have changed the world. I am guided by the following questions. What might an engagement with literature written by Black Americans teach us about the United States and its quest for democracy? What might it teach us about the fullest blossoming of our own humanity? What I offer here is a series of meditations on the fundamental questions of humanity, reality, politics, and art. Each chapter addresses a specific body of work and the issues it raises. Although you do not have to have read the books I discuss in order to grasp the lessons I share, I hope my words will entice you to pick up these works and to read them. To do so will only enrich your experience, understanding, and life. the voices that denounced chattel slavery, that spoke to the promise of meaningful freedom, that voiced pleas for justice, which made the Constitution a living document, the promise of which one day could be made real, have much to teach us. But even more than this, these works speak to us beyond the narrow boundaries of race and nation. They explore timeless values that guide us, reminding us of our responsibility to ourselves and others. All Americans, indeed all freedom-loving people, should have exposure to and an understanding of this body of work. It reminds us of paths taken that should be avoided and paths not taken that may have yielded different futures. It encourages us to learn the bitter truths of our history, as well as the transcendent beauty and humanity of some of our responses to it. This strikes me as especially urgent now more than ever, when so many Americans appear ignorant of our history and of the importance of the democracy they claim to revere. In the questions that I raise throughout these pages, I have been deeply influenced by a lifelong intellectual, aesthetic, political, and spiritual engagement with the writings of the late Toni Morrison. Informed by her writing, I ask a series of questions of selected works by Black writers. The authors do not posit or forward a system of ethics, but they do seem to bear witness to one that emerges from the community about whom they write.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
In the midst of a hostile society, a society that wants our labor or our death, we live in pursuit of justice, in pursuit of freedom, and longing for a bit of grace. How shall we? How shall we live? How shall we treat each other? How shall we treat our compatriots, some of whom are guilty of crimes against us?
Thank you so much. I love that introduction and all of the things it invokes. And it's a really powerful intervention and argument, a reiteration of Black literature is canon, and specifically for people who are, I think, rightfully interested in the intersections between art and citizenry. And Toni Morrison's work has been banned in various places and various contexts for a long time, continues to be banned. And yet a hallmark of her work, I think, is, you know, her engagement with goodness and morality, which you call to. And as you mentioned in the book, Ayanna Mathis describes Toni Morrison as being both lighthouse and anchor, which I think is such a lovely phrase. I love the idea that someone can be both an anchor that grounds someone in reality and sort of says, you know, this is the plain truth, asking them to look more closely at their surroundings, but simultaneously giving them something to look towards, like a kind of light just beyond the shore. And the argument we often hear as to why novels like The Bluest Eye or many of the others that you mentioned in your book are removed from classrooms or libraries or other kinds of spaces is that the content can cause a sort of secondhand trauma for readers. And while there's certainly some truth to this, you also note very carefully Morrison's ethic of care, her writing about Black love as resistance and Black community as resistance. And you yourself, you know, make very explicit that you are beginning, you're ending the book on a note of grace. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the value of discomfort and also the value of care and depicting trauma and harm without reenacting it.
Well, the best art makes us uncomfortable. There's an unsettling moment. We confront something, and then the best artists also know how to help us think about resolving this. How might we resolve it? But you have to have the discomfort, right? Even for the drama, you have to have the discomfort for the touching of our own humanity. And we're only being asked to read this material. We're not being asked to experience the violence. There are people who actually experienced it. What Morrison asks us to do and what she says literature can do, and I think many writers, is it is our responsibility to bear witness to suffering. It is our responsibility to bear witness and to bear witness so that we help ensure it does not happen, not on our watch, right? that that's what a confrontation with history and literature can bring to us. And so she will give us some characters who are utterly destroyed. And we ask, how can we make sure that not happened? How could that have not happened? That was not inevitable. There were a set of human choices that made that happen. There are other characters who experience trauma, and yet through the care of others and community are able to incorporate that experience of trauma into themselves as they move forward. And one of the examples I always give is in Beloved, Setha, the runaway slave, has been brutally beaten. She encounters a young white woman who is also a runaway and an indentured servant who has also been beaten and who is prejudiced, who has her own racism. But she's human and she cares for this suffering woman and helps her one leg on her journey. That's also in the literature. And to make it only about the trauma and the suffering is a very limited reading of a very complicated set of text.
I mean, I find, well, I want to talk in a minute. I want to talk about what the roots are, I think, of this sort of book banning business. But, you know, for me, Ralph Ellison was one of the most inspirational and positive writers. Not that he, diminished, right, the difficulties of Black American life, but that he awoke me as a white reader and citizen to the greatness promise of America in a way that I hadn't really thought about. And I viewed his, I'm thinking of an essay like The Little Man at Cheeha Station, where he's talking about what's great about American art. That's not just Black art, that's American art. And when I teach that essay to students of any race, I often try to tell them, look, this is a positive way. Not very many people are talking positively about America, but if you want to look at people who believe in writers who have articulated what the promise of America is, Black literature is great for that. That is a source that is incredibly powerful. And I feel like this is what is missed in this discussion.
It's totally missed. And it's certainly what one of the goals of the book is to say, the writers who have reminded us so often of the promise because they've had to are the writers from this tradition, right? Is a reminder that this is what we can be. This is what we are working toward. And Ellison more so than anyone, certainly.
And I thought it was so likely, Whitney, that you would bring this up that I put this next to me for the conversation.
That's right behind me. That's an ease on my nonfiction shelf here.
And I was thinking of the essay about the novel in American Democracy as I was reading your book also. And yeah, I think this is, I mean, such a rich example. And throughout the book, throughout your book, you have many specific examples of scenes where Black community, Black love, like Black care, as you're describing, and care from Black communities towards others, as you're describing it in Beloved, is like a really constant thread throughout the book, which is, I think, something that I really appreciated about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think of, we all have our go-to writers, and Morrison is mine, but so is Baldwin, who never turns away, is, kind of unflinching in confronting what is difficult, and insists that we do. Talk about a writer who bears witness, but who also believes in the transformative potential of human interaction and care. In a novel like If Beale Street Could Talk, a poor family, wrongly convicted young man, a young woman who's about to have his baby, and they are taken care of not only by their families, their nuclear families, but in that novel, there are these ever-widening circles, a Hasidic Jewish landlord who will rent to them when no one else will, Spanish restaurant workers who will feed them when they don't have any money, an Italian immigrant store owner who testifies against the police officer who brutalizes the young Black man. There are these ever-widening sense of possibility of what we can be as citizens of a multiracial democracy, while confronting the horrible things that people have had to undergo here.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break right here, and we'll be right back.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
I want to trace this back a little bit to what I think is really the source of the targeting of Black literature right now, which, I mean, this has been going on forever in America, so I'm not going to say this is the beginning point. But the 1619 project that Nicole Hannah-Jones did, and that became, I think, that it seems to me like the right realized, like, if they use the term critical race theory, and we already did an episode on this, that was a successful, like, political rallying cry to the, you know, racist white base at the conservative party, my personal simple view, right? And so they recognized, and tell me if you think this is a crazy theory, like they recognize, I can't just say, like, I don't like Toni Morrison because they're talking about things that, you know, they're talking about oppression that I find uncomfortable. They have to say, like, let's talk about the sex part of this instead. It's like it's a trick, really.
Oh, it's a distraction.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, you're right. You're right. It's a total distraction. And I think I think it's the power of the 1619 Project. But I tell you what I also think. When I saw all those young people after George Floyd, and not just young people, when I saw all those people hit the street, you know, who basically said, I see with my eyes what this is, and you're not going to tell me that my eyes aren't seeing what I see. You've done that before, but you're not going to do that now because I know what this is. I've been taught what it is, right? You've got two generations of young white people who are now grown and have children who have read Morrison, who have read Baldwin, who have had exposure in their classrooms to the very materials that people want to ban. And what does it do? It makes them stand up and say, no, not on my watch, right? I'm not going to watch this. And I think the power of that is so frightening that is also why you see this move toward, we've got to stop this. We don't want this in our schools. What are you indoctrinating our children with? We don't want them exposed to this traumatic, this stuff that traumatizes them, that makes them feel guilty, you know.
Or that makes them realize that all the crap that we're saying is wrong.
Is wrong. Is wrong.
And I think one of the other things about this is so interesting to think about is that in your book, one of the most powerful examples of an educator is your father, who pervades you this wonderful love of literature, who makes sure that, who is, I think you use the phrase, that it's not an uncritical patriotism, but like a really, right, this sort of very engaged reading. He introduces you to this great body of work. And this is all a kind of education that actually happens outside of school. And I just was thinking about, and I found all of this, the stuff about your father really moving, and I was thinking about how powerfully education exists outside of school walls in Black communities, because right, you're talking about the young white people who hit the streets. They learned Morrison in school, but would they have found Morrison outside of school? Would they have maybe not, right? And so it seems to me like communities that have not been able to trust public institutions to preserve, protect, present their histories are the ones that have these strong, independent, like oral, intergenerational traditions of radical educational literature, like the notion that like it is your parents' job or your elders' job to sit you down and sort of be like, this is who Angela Davis is. And I wonder, like, in a world in which we can't maybe, I don't know what's going to happen with book banning. I mean, it seems like there's a certain amount of backlash, of course, towards it. And there's also this kind of, like, short-term memory loss, which is sort of, then it happens again. It seems like a cycle. And I wonder, like, how we can also learn from that non-institutional educational tradition.
Well, you know, you hit the nail on the head about why I wrote this book, because I was, you know, I wanted to share the things that I share in my classroom with people who will never be in my classroom, because I didn't come to this material in the classroom. And not only did I not come, I eventually did, but as a child, I didn't. And not only did I not come to it in the classroom, my parents didn't expect, they had no expectation that the school was going to teach me this, And in fact, they were countering what they thought I might get in school. You know, they were of a generation that read racist children's literature, right? So they were countering what I might get in school. This is the truth of our people. And I think this is true for all oppressed people. How do we pass down to our children the truth of who they are and the truth of their history to basically build them up against the sort of onslaught that they're going to get? I think also I heard a wonderful idea. Someone said, you know, we can take all those banned books and actually make a curriculum for outside of school to teach young people, right? And now we have all kinds of ways to do it. Let's read the banned books together. It's a community building effort. It's an intergenerational effort. And it's something that we have a tradition of having done.
The other thing about that is that there's a I think the intensity and the reason that the banning books, the idea of banning books that are viewed as an ideological threat comes back is a recognition of the asymmetrical power of the writer. That is one of the, that Toni Morrison is extremely powerful. She's not a corporation. She doesn't have, own a bunch of land, but she has, by her power in her art, created a power that is very difficult for her ideological opponents to wrestle with. And that, for me, is inspirational as a writer, right? It was the thing that taught me reading Black writers who had that effect and been able to establish a cultural beachhead like that in America is inspirational because it tells you what writing can do.
Some of Toni Morrison's best writing about exactly what you're talking about. I mean, they're her novels, but then they're also her essays. She was a fierce advocate for writers who were oppressed around the world. And there are essays and articles that she wrote for Pen America. There's a beautiful one called Peril about why we have to protect writers and that the loss of the writer is not only bad for the writer, it's bad for us, that writers are essential. They're not extra. They're essential to us as human beings and to human society. And she recognized and knew that power and knew the power of language. And she said, even in that essay, she says, oftentimes autocrats are fools. She says, but none is so foolish as to give full, unfettered, freedom to the writer, because they know the power of the writer and the power of people who are engaged by what writers have to say.
So I'm curious, I mean, I totally agree with what you're saying. And I have also just been thinking about the ways that as censorship increases, at least in my own community, my family is Tamil and Sri Lankan, and in different Sri Lankan communities around the world, I've sort of seen the creep of self-censorship in different spaces, sometimes just in conversations that used to be more open. And I wonder what you think of how kind of the increase in, even the uptick in conversation about banned books affects writers and critics. What does it mean for, I don't know, Whitney, myself, you, to be writing in a world where we know that that's a possibility?
I look throughout history and I think that certainly it will cause some self-censoring amongst some writers. Writers are human beings and we are, we have fears and concerns and families and this sense of writing into the void, no one's going to hear it. But in every time, in every instance in history, there are writers who keep writing. Even at the risk of their own lives, we have writers who are not only banned, who are jailed, right? I think that the conviction that some artists have is similar to the conviction that activists have, who know what awaits them but they still do it. And so Morrison says, imagine a world without the art, right? She's like, I don't want to live in that world. And I think that certainly, there are some who would like us to live in that world. But I think that there will always be the people who are writing in prison. I was reading just recently about someone writing in a concentration camp and how it was snuck, somebody rolled it up and snuck it out, right? That's our history as writers. That's our history too. And so I think the self-censorship is a danger, but I think that artists will produce and writers will continue to write what they understand to be the truth.
I always think about a letter from Birmingham Jail, which was also an essay, written by Martin Luther King that was reliant on and thought about and was connected to Thoreau, And so there is this inner racial connection in among writers and over time. And it's one of also something that Ellison emphasized, that people borrow from each other, and that one of the things that makes our country strong in the arts is the borrowing. And, you know, that positive aspect, again, is the thing that's missed by people who are like, I don't want to, you know, that we quoted a Texas state representative in the prior episode, who had a list of 850 books that he had said to the school board were something that might make people feel uncomfortable. Maybe we should look at banning these. And as you were saying, like, you were talking about the Black Lives Matter movement, like, many of them were just like, Black Lives Matter, anything that mentioned Black Lives Matter, we're going to take that out. And you're saying, and I think you're right, that his concern is that not just that white Americans who were involved in those protests and saw them and began to see, you know, what is really happening here, are going to sort of get out from under his thumb, is what it feels like to me.
I think it's wanting to control everything, right? Yeah. It's wanting to control white people, keep them, you know, and that's what many people never understand, right? Is that you control, if the impulse is to control a population, the impulse is to control people, right? So you might try to control what access, you know, what people write, what education, what the quality of education that is available to young Black children so they don't even know how to write. And then the quality of education of what's available to white people so that they don't have access to it. You have closed societies like apartheid South Africa. And after the fall of apartheid, you had white people in South Africa realizing there were things that their own government was keeping from them too. So the impulse to control is the impulse to control the entire society. The violence is felt among certain populations a little more harshly.
By the people who are determined to be the other, right, yeah.
You know, but I think, and what you said about speaking interracially, it's also speaking through time. Like, writers speak through time, right? We writers read people from other continents and get that sort of nourishment there and see themselves as part of that legacy and tradition.
And that was one of the things that I really appreciated about your book, that it wasn't organized by time period, that I think so much of that, that critical race theory rhetoric is also kind of trying to say the past is the past, and the past is not that far past as we know. But also the way that you organize by theme allows this really interesting conversation across periods of time, which is always going on, but which is, I think, sometimes really hard to kind of, because of the ways that English departments, among other things, are organized. You know, I just was asking my
17th century.
Yeah, literature. Right. I was just asking my older kid, when I say the word periodicity to you, what do you think that means? And right, you know, the ways in which that is kind of limiting. I mean, it's from one lens, obviously really valuable, but I think in the framework that in which you're writing about freedom, and the conversation across generations, I think, is one of the really lovely things in this book, and also the way that the arc of the questions kind of moves and from like rage and resistance to grace, to see the ways that those different themes are brought up by different writers across so much time, right? Like, there actually
across
is some
time.
Yeah, across so much time.
Yeah, and they're reading each other. You know, like the younger writers are reading. I try to show how, you know, Barack Obama, who is a writer and an intellectual as well as a politician, I try to show how it's evident that he's read not only the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, and he's read Niebuhr, and he's read Baldwin, and he's read Malcolm X, because he is in conversation with him in the book. He's read all of these people, you know, Rawls on justice. I mean, that all of these are informing, they're all part of our toolkit, right? And there are no boundaries, artificial boundaries, to what is part of our sort of intellectual and artistic toolkit that we have access to, as long as the banners aren't successful. And I think we have to just make the idea of banning books, the books that I don't agree with, you know, I want access to them. I want to be able to disagree with them. I don't want to live in a world where the answer is you ban a book. Like, that's not the society that we should be striving for at all.
It also seems to me like something that fundamentally weakens, I mean, it just weakens critical thought, and that everyone becomes less capable of interesting and, like, interesting argument, interesting and rigorous argument. I mean, there's a part in your book where you're writing about sort of the concept of the outdoors, and you write about you're writing about the bluest eye, and it seems to me like banning books is a way of trying to put something outdoors, whereas mm-hmm. to exclude something to you refer to the quote unquote the throat out child.
Yes,
and actually that sort of is also that's what the book banners are trying to do, and so. If we don't succeed in having some sort of more inventive conversation about this, if you end up with this set of, say, white readers who have this lack of knowledge about our own literary history and cultural history, and what does our democracy look like? And we always like to throw these future questions in at the end. What does our democracy look like in 30 years?
Well, you don't have a democracy that bans books. You don't have a democracy that... that tries to keep its population from having access to information. And any group of people that really want to stop critical thinking, because that's what it is. It's not critical race theory, right? That's the boogeyman, because they're not even talking about critical race theory. It's a population that thinks critically. Now, they don't mind if they think conspiratorially, right? And they'll say that to think conspiratorially is to think critically. It's ridiculous. But a population that thinks critically is not a population that can be controlled in that way. And so I think that's what the goal is. The goal is to not have a population that thinks critically, not have a population that can understand dialogue, be in conversation. There is no democracy without that dialogue as citizens. There is no democracy without an informed citizenry. And that's what they don't want. Is an informed, you know, what did, the man who was president say, I love the uneducated. Well, it's not just the uneducated, because uneducated people can be also critical thinkers and smart. He's like, I love the people who don't think is what he loves, right? The people who don't think.
I wanted to, and this is just, and we're about to wrap up here, but okay. I wanted to add to, you know, we talked about the 1619 Project and maybe that is a source for this new wave of book branding, but I also think that, and I wondered what you thought about this. What it strikes me is that when I was going to high school in 1980s, in essence, the books that are in your book were at my high school banned without being said that they were banned because nobody taught black writers at my high school, period. Now, they do. Now, my son goes to the same school. And I think increasingly on the high school level, there's been a large push and a consciousness that more diverse books do need to be read. And suddenly... a certain segment of our population is waking up and being like, wait a second, we want to go back to the old ways where these things were shadow banned or sort of just it was understood that they would not be taught. Is it possibly that that's part of the deal here?
Oh, it's definitely part of the deal. I mean, I didn't grow up reading these books in school either, right? I was in school in the late 70s, early 80s. I read them on my own. I read them with friends, but not in school. And then, as you say, things changed and you started reading them. But it's not just, we want to go back. We want to go back to the days when people didn't have the right to vote. We want to go back to the days when women didn't have control over their own bodies, right?
That's when everything was great again.
That's when all was great. Yeah. It was all great. And we want to go back to it. And it's these darn books where they didn't read books about two mommies, right? That's what has changed us for the worse. We want to go back. And so it's all, I think it's part and parcel of a far right shift and public schools and school boards and curricula that has always been, one of the sites of struggle and contestation. And it's not only black children who suffer, white children suffer too. And, it's these moves, to stop people from voting. It impacts black voters and brown voters, but it'll impact poor white voters too. We are the canaries in the coal mine. So I think that's the danger. That's the danger.
It's so interesting to hear the two of you talk about this work not being taught at school, because where I went to school, it was taught. And I have these specific memories of reading The Bluest Eye and, the autobiography of Malcolm X. And, it was that my brother had been assigned those books and I went into his room and filched them. And I was definitely, probably too young to be reading them. And also they were just so brilliant. Like I would just sort of wait until everyone left the house and then I would go get them. But then also they were taught in school. And so It's hard for me to even imagine classroom spaces without this work, because I guess, you know, I've grown up very privileged with access to them. So it's amazing to hear.
It's a different, I think in different contexts they've been taught, in different locations they've been taught. I think that one of the things that I often think is that, you know, in the United States, one of the goals of white supremacy was to call into question the intellectual ability of Black people. And so you can't call into question their intellectual ability if you have young people reading these books. I mean, you know, you can't do that. So it makes the project of saying that people don't have the capacity to think, it makes it a little bit easier to do, to tell that lie if you keep people from reading what they've written.
Farah, we want to thank you for joining us. Listeners, you can hear more of what Farah Jasmine Griffin says on Twitter, and be sure to grab a copy of Read Until You Understand, The Profound Wisdom of Black Life and Literature.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us. That's it for this episode of the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast from Literary Hub. This show is produced by Anne Kniggendorf. To subscribe to Fiction Nonfiction, please type fiction/non/fiction into your favorite podcast app. We'd love to hear your ideas and feedback. You can reach us at fictionnonfictionpodcast@gmail.com, on Twitter at FNFTalk, on Facebook at FNFPod, and on Instagram at fiction.non.fiction.podcast. In each of these places, you'll find links to our LitHub radio show notes, including some of the readings we mentioned in this episode. You can also find video versions of our episodes on our YouTube channel. Our website, with our full video and audio archive and episodes grouped by theme for educators, is at fnfpodcast.net. In recent days, we've been waiting on tenterhooks to see if Russian President Putin is going to order an invasion of Ukraine, so I especially want to point listeners back just a few weeks to our Ukraine episode, which featured New York Times Moscow bureau chief Anton Troinovsky and Yale historian Marcy Shore. That was a really informative conversation and has helped me to understand more recent developments. We're watching the news closely, and we know you are too. Until next time, that's it for the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast from Literary Hub.